From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, it's our summer book show. Most of you know it by now, but if you don't, here's how it works. We invite book experts, local booksellers, to join us with lists of books and actual stacks of books, and they go through them and they offer suggestions for those of you who need a good book for the beach or for camping or for whatever you're doing this summer season. There's fiction and nonfiction and kids' books. So grab a pen and join us after this.
With the KUER app, you'll never have to choose between Doug Fabrizio and a phone call from your spouse. Just hit the pause button and take the call. When you're ready, hit play and it's back to Radio West. The KUER app lets you pause whatever you're listening to. And you can get a constant feed of BBC News and classical music with our other streams, BBC on KUER and KUER Classical. It's even got an alarm clock, so you can wake up with Diane Mezzapinto's Moon Report and Morning Edition. Download the KUER app for iPhone and Android today. It'll help you be a better partner.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It turns out we've been doing these book shows for something like 15 years now, where we gather our group of local booksellers to offer ideas for summer reading. And by now, we've worked out a decent system. We've fine-tuned the segments, we've played around with the timing, the readings, we've included a lightning round. But no matter what we do, we never get to the bottom of anyone's book list, which is a good thing, actually. There's only so much time, and there are a lot of books to talk about. So what we do and have done for the last 15 years or so is we do our best, and I've learned to jump in as quickly as possible. So you may want to grab something to take notes, but if you don't, not to worry. We will have a list of all of the books we'll get to, even those we won't, on our website, radiowest.org. Okay, let me introduce our cast of regulars, and we'll jump in. Betsy Burton back with us, co-owns the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake City. And welcome back.
Hi, thanks, Doug.
Catherine Weller back with us, new book buyer for Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. Welcome back to you.
Thanks, Doug.
Ken Sanders is back with us, the owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books in downtown Salt Lake City. And welcome back.
Always a pleasure, Doug.
Okay, I do want to begin before we do, in fact, jump in. Give me a sense of what's going on right now in the book world. What are you noticing? What are people asking for? Betsy mentioned off the air just before we went on that business is good, but what are people wanting?
Well, business is good, but the world is in a sorry state. So I think people are, among other things, wanting books that will cheer them up, books that they can escape into, or books that really nail what's going on in the world in a significant way. The good news is that the book business in general is just flourishing. And at the King's English, we've even started a publishing company with Ann Cannon's new book called TKE Inc. Wow. So we're all looking for ways to do things more broadly, and it's fun. It's fun.
It's about time, Betsy.
Oh, be quiet.
Ken has been doing this for a while.
You have been.
Kat, what are you noticing?
Oh, yeah, pretty much that. Yeah. It is the resurgence of my current affairs and political science sections. They went to sleep for a while, and there were, you know, a few core titles and, of course, certain economics titles that were big, but now those sections are just exploding again as people are wanting to explore what is happening in the world and how we navigate this thing, this country, this world that we're in right now.
I want to say one word, not just to Betsy, but about publishing in general, Doug. Publishing, by my definition, is where you spend all of this money, whether it's $5,000, $10,000, $25,000 on a book up front. And if you're a successful publisher, you will live long enough to recoup the cost of that book. The book trade, I think there are more small independent new bookstores springing up, as we all already know. Print is outselling digital after years of reversal, but it's also a parallel in the used book world where I live, and it couldn't be a better time in a really weird sense, because the availability of books on the internet has kind of collapsed the global price structure of them. Mm-hmm. And whether you go mm-hmm. into our stores that sell used books or online to buy, prices are cheaper than they've ever been. Now, it's a bit of a downside if you're selling because everyone's paying less as well. Yeah. But if you're a student or a person on a budget that is a reader, boy, it's a great time to be able to buy dystopian fiction or important feminist works or what have you.
Yeah. Great. Okay. All right. Let's go. Betsy Burton, you're up first.
Okay. And as usual, I'm going to start with fiction, talking about Michael Ondaatje's new book, Warlight. Michael Ondaatje, who wrote The English Patient, hasn't really returned to World War II until now. This book takes place just after World War II or just at the end of it. And it is a thriller wrapped in a mystery, wrapped in a coming-of-age story. It's just wonderful. The main characters are two kids. One, really, Nathaniel, who's 14. His sister, Rachel, is 18. Their mother abandons them and leaves them in a house in London with a guy they've met once called the Moth. They call him the Moth, whom they are convinced is a criminal. And so they roam the city of London as young teenagers, and get in all manner of trouble. They live an unbridled life, and they don't know what happened to their mother. They know she lied to them. That's all they know. So then you fast forward after this wild, unruly time, house full of people like dog smugglers and divas and just a great cast of characters. You shift to the time when Nathaniel is 29, looking back, trying to figure out what happened to his mother, what she was up to when she disappeared, what was going on then, what's going on now, which is the mystery part. The characters are as vivid as they can be. It is absolutely brilliantly written, but it is also a book you can't put down. It is just wonderful. It is Warlight by Michael Ondaatje. And he came to the store, and he's just as brilliant as his books. He's wonderful.
Yeah, great.
So then the next book I want to talk about is by Sheila Hetty. She is Canadian. The book is called Motherhood. It purports to be a memoir, and it's structured in a kind of question and answer, but it is very much a novel. And the novel centers around the question of, should this writer, who has a rich, full life and a lover, become a mother, or should she not? Hmm. So I think it's a book every woman should read, every man who wants to understand women, because whether you've made that decision or not doesn't matter. It is such an important moment in every woman's life when she makes that choice or chooses not to or has it made for her. So it is absolutely cleanly and brilliantly written. The question and answer format is very interesting, but it is really a world-changing book, and I think every woman should read it.
Wow. Say the title again.
Motherhood.
Motherhood.
Sheila Hetty. Then a book of a very different kind is There, There by Tommy Orange. Tommy Orange has written really the first, Ken reminds me, not the first, but the first really out there novel about the American Indian who is an urban American Indian as opposed to somebody off the reservation or just out in nature. And this book takes place in Oakland. The fulcrum for it is a powwow. The characters, and there are many of them, stretched across the city. There are some violent or prone to be violent teenagers. There is someone who is trying to quit drinking, a young woman. There's somebody who wants to do his native dance, and he finds out how to do it on YouTube, and now he's going to do it for the first time. There's just all manner of interesting characters slowly coming together. You're sensing violence might be part of what happens. His voice is rich and funny and full of pain and yearning, and it really gives you what it's like to be an American Indian who is an urban American Indian. We have lots in Salt Lake. We have an active urban population of Native Americans here, and we need to know what their lives are like. This is really an important book. And just quickly,
just There, There.
There, There by Tommy Orange, a wonderful new book. And then just quickly, Happiness, a novel by Aminata Forna, is about a young woman who is researching the urban fox and a psychiatrist from Ghana who is looking for a young boy who's his nephew's son, and their search through the city and each other's lives for meaning. Very crisply written, a great read, Happiness by Aminata Forna.
Great. Ken Sanders.
Doug, I think 2018 is the year of new books by dead authors, and I'll explain that a bit more later. Death is always a great business for any author. You always sell more dead than alive. There are two new Charles Bukowski books out.
Wow. Yeah.
This one with the great, I'm sure for radio, the great Robert Crumb cover, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think Buck titled this one himself, The Mathematics of the Breath and the Way. That does not sound like a Charles Bukowski title to me, but it's a great new essay or great new collection of essays on Bukowski on writing never before published. The other new, there's two new Charles Bukowskis out, Storm for the Living and the Dead. That sounds a little more Bukowski.
Yeah, it does.
Is a new collection of previously unpublished poetry by one of the great urban
stuff?
Poets. Charles Bukowski was one heck of a prolific writer, Doug. John Martin at Black Sparrow couldn't possibly keep up with him.
Yeah.
So I highly recommend anybody that likes Bukowski's type of writing, and there are plenty that don't. He's pretty gritty, and he's pretty urban, and he's pretty filthy, but he's a great poet and novelist. Post Office is my favorite. To return to a living author who's gone way back in the past, I think Craig Childs is just getting deeper and deeper and better with every book he does. This is hardly his first book about the past because he did the great prehistoric Southwest Indian book. But Atlas of the Lost World is his new book, subtitled Travels in Ice Age America. And he really takes us back. And I think to understand the present, we have to go back to the past. And he does a brilliant job of walking us through our ancient past. And I think it helps understand the future where he's gone before with Apocalyptic Planet, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, he went way back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, way back.
Yeah. It's so terrific. We had him on the show.
Yeah, he's really a great, important regional
voice. And that's a great book.
It's terrific.
Really is. It is. Yeah. Absolutely.
And then to switch gears for just a minute, Joe Nesbo, who is one of the great living mystery writers of our day, has written a new one called Macbeth. Now, Macbeth ain't got nothing to do with Shakespeare. That's the name of the police inspector in the novel. I just think he's one of the grittiest, best mystery writers we have right now, and he's left his Harry Hole, or however on earth you pronounce that inspector's name, Hole, in the Norwegian. I don't know how to pronounce it, but those books are funny because he makes fun of his inspector's name and does plays on words with it. But he's left Inspector H behind, and a new series and a great novel, and to go from
Macbeth
Joe by Joe Nesbo, yeah, and to go to true crime from well, I don't want to call it fake crime, but mystery novels, is Michelle McNamara's All Be Gone in the Dark, which is subtitles One Woman's Obsessive Search for the Golden State Killer. There's a lot of drama over this book, did this book reactivate the interest in the crime and lead to the solving or not? And the police seem to be downplaying that. It seems kind of coincidental to me. I think she ought to be given some credit for it. And for those that like true crime novels, this is as good as it gets.
Great.
I'll Be Gone in the Dark.
I'll Be Gone in the Dark. Okay. Kat.
All right. Finding Stillness in a Noisy World is the new book from Jana Richman. This is hot off the press from the University of Utah Press. Pivoting off of something Ken said, this is a book of essays, and it's a book of essays towards understanding, and what she's doing is trying to understand her world now by exploring the past and exploring where she is currently. I have a passage to read. And it's talking about home and where she is now in her world. When I highlight desert in Microsoft Word and click on the handy thesaurus and dictionary function, certainly not an exhaustive or authoritative source, but one that represents mainstream thinking, the following terms pop up: wasteland, deprived place, lifeless place, barren region, desolate tract. If I open the synonym finder, I can add dust bowl, no man's land, devoid, empty, destitute, poor, deficit, uncultivatable, unproductive. We believe these words. They are part of our American sensibilities, part of our consciousness. They are what allowed the Mormons to make Utah's desert bloom like a rose. They are what drive us to cover deserts with malls and golf courses and lawns. It is easier to hide from oneself in the city than it is in an open desert. Much easier to distract oneself from whatever pain or shame or fear flows just under the skin. A desert will confront a person, which might be why we treat them so shabbily, refuse to let them be, rush to cover them with concrete and roses. The day after I return home from the city, I drive the desolate tract called Hole in the Rock Road to the barren region known as Harris Wash. From there, I walk several miles through the wasteland of flowing pink sand, pinyon pine, juniper, sage, and wheatgrass before settling into the lifeless place between soaring rust-red sandstone walls and a cornflower blue sky. She goes on to talk about the essays in the collection and how she does explore what she does so magnificently. Her roots is somebody growing up in Tooele, Utah, the descendant of handcart pioneers, traces her lineage all the way back to Joseph Smith, founders of the church, and somebody who understands rural Utah and the mindset of rural Utah, and somebody who is an environmentalist, feminist, Buddhist, who understands that too and is trying to seek understanding and seek paths forward, as I said earlier, to find a way to live in this modern world. These are compact essays. They're not big sprawling essays. Each chapter, each essay is a chapter, and it begins with an epigraph by another prominent essayist, say people we know well like Ellen Molloy, Rebecca Solnit, people from the past like Bertrand Russell. It she pivots off of those initial quotes beautifully in her essays. This is well worth the not a great deal of time it would take to read it, but it's worth reading it again after you read it the first time. It's called Finding Stillness in a Noisy World by Jana Richman.
Great. All right, Ken Sanders, we're back to you.
Okay, so I want to switch gears again, as always. There's this new edition out of a book by Joanna Rush. It's called How to Suppress Women's Writing. I just want to read to you from the cover briefly. She didn't write it, but if it's clear she did the deed, she wrote it, but she shouldn't have. It's political, sexual, masculine, feminist. She wrote it, but look what she wrote about the bedroom, the kitchen, her family, other women. She wrote it, but she wrote only one of it. Jane Eyre, poor dear, that's all she ever. She wrote it, but she really isn't an artist, and it isn't really art. It's a thriller, a romance, a children's book. It's sci-fi. She wrote it, but she had help. Robert Browning, Bronwell Bronte, her own masculine side. She wrote it, but she's an anomaly. Wolf, with Leonard's help. She wrote it, but... And it's just a brilliant, brilliant, really fresh look at why we don't value women in this society. But here's the sad thing. This is a reissue of a book she first wrote in 1983. Wow. And what on earth has changed? Apparently nothing, ladies.
Nothing.
How to Suppress Women's Writing, Joanna Rush. Wow. Highly recommend it.
Great.
Publish your own.
Yeah. There you go. Hey, you started a publishing company. Go for it. Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of State, Ambassador to the UN, and many other well-respected positions over the years, has a new historical to now look out, a book called Fascism, a Warning by Madeleine Albright, that really tells the story of fascism through the entire 20th century, but especially pointing out the parallels today that others certainly are doing. But I think hers is a welcome voice to anti-fascism, and she certainly parallels it with what's going on in our nation's capital today with very concrete and real parallels and answers, I think. So I highly recommend Fascism by Madeleine Albright. I want to turn quickly to local for a minute. You'll remember these 3D publisher guys came out with the Zion book and some others. They got a brand new edition, Wasatch 3D.
Out. Ken's taking out his 3D glasses.
Why do I have my reading glasses on? They don't work with 3D, Doug. These are you have to have the glasses on, but these just really are, it's fun. You can just zero in, and it's like, oh, they kind of scare you because these mountains are kind of high. But it's just so much fun. And I meant that in a literal sense, Fabrizio. I know where you're going.
What's the name of that again?
It's called cool. Wasatch 3D. And it comes
3D.
With two pairs of glasses in case you lose one.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's wonderful to see these mountains we so know and love up close and personal, shall we say.
Terrific.
And lastly, of course I'm going to do a non-book item. I have to. I mean, it's my reputation. The late, great Rosalie Sorrells, even though she was an Idahoan, she lived here for many years. She's very, very famous here, and she knew everybody in the music industry and beyond. She was almost a childhood friend with Hunter S. Thompson. Ken Kesey took further the bus and the whole acid test to her house in Grimes Creek in Idaho. They've put out this 4-volume CD tribute to her music that's got almost everybody in the business paying tribute to the late, great Rosalie Sorrells. Brand new, just out on CD.
Great.
Thank you.
Ken Sanders, good job. Okay, Betsy, we're back to you.
Okay, so the book of the year, in my opinion, the book that just blew me away, and maybe the book of the decade. I know I've said this before, but not since All the Light We Cannot See. So it's been fine.
You say that every once in a while, but that's good. That's good. Yeah.
No, she's right this time.
It
well,
is.
She was about that, but this is huge.
Yeah. It's huge. It's magnificent. It is an amazing book. If you're not really religious, but you have a religion that is about the world around you, this is the Bible. It is incredible. But it's fiction. So, it's a cast of characters, 8 or 9 of them. Each one, when you start to read the story, is like dipping into a delicious novel. He's a brilliant writer. Each one tied to a tree, which sounds schematic, but you learn more about specific trees than you'll ever know in your lifetime, or have before in your lifetime, unless you study them for a living. And the characters are intriguing. A couple who only know trees through what they see out of their window in their backyard, who read a lot, a woman who studies them for a living, a statistician. They're just gamers who do it for games. Anyway, it's a wonderful, wonderful story. And the thing that is so significant about it is that all these stories begin to coalesce, to weave together. And the real point of the book is the weaving together. The trees which don't stand alone but weave together. They are a society. Everything is connected in this book. All the trees are connected. They're connected to their environment. The people are connected. And it is so moving when you get to the end and you see this brilliant vision of connection. Now, one of the main characters in this book is a woman who's a research scientist. And she's known as Plant Patty. And early on in the book, she decides that there is something to this. You know, the trees somehow are talking to each other. This is a long time ago. Can it be? Can it possibly be? No, of course it can't be. No scientist would think that. But she does research, and she starts to think, I'm beginning to prove this. This could be. This could change everything. And in the passage we're about to hear, she has done enough work to know she's right, but she needs to go another season and make sure. And that's the place in the beginning of the new season where this reading starts.
This is read by the actress Suzanne Torin.
Confirmation comes the following spring. 3 more trials, and she's convinced. The trees under attack pump out insecticides to save their lives. That much is uncontroversial, but something else in the data makes her flesh pucker. Trees a little way off, untouched by the invading swarms, ramp up their own defenses when their neighbor is attacked. Something alerts them. They get wind of the disaster, and they prepare. She controls for everything she can, and the results are always the same. Only one conclusion makes any sense. the wounded trees send out alarms that other trees smell. Her maples are signaling. They're linked together in an airborne network, sharing an immune system across acres of woodland. These brainless, stationary trunks are protecting each other. She can't quite let herself believe, but the data keep confirming. And on that evening, when Patricia finally accepts what the measurements say, her limbs heat up and tears run down her face. For all she knows, she's the first creature in the expanding adventure of life who has ever glimpsed this small but certain thing that evolution is up to. Life is talking to itself, and she has listened in.
Gives you chills, huh?
Does. Wait, so but is that true?
That is absolutely true.
Okay. And
in fact, it's known science now. I'll talk about that later. But back then, it was not known at all.
And this is this revelation to her. And she's this character. Of course, this is all fiction, but it's all...
Well, and it's questioned through the novel by other scientists who just poo-poo it.
Yeah.
But in the end, they can't deny it because it's true.
The overstory, Richard Powers. So you're effusive about it, both of you.
It's magnificent. The writing is magnificent. The vision of our world is just stunning. And it gives you faith. We need faith. It gives you faith.
It is beautiful writing. It is truly one of those books that's... Weaving is right. It's a tapestry. The stories interweave seamlessly. He is... One of our great novelists, really. He has written so many wonderful books, and
Margaret
this
Atwood,
is above and beyond.
Margaret Atwood said of him, you know, if he'd lived in that time, he would have been the one to write Moby Dick.
I think she's right.
Betsy Burton and Catherine Weller. Betsy joins us, of course, from the King's English at 15th and 15. Catherine from Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square. We also have with us Ken Sanders, of course, of Ken Sanders Rare Books on 2nd East in Salt Lake City. Remember, we have a list, the list of all of these books, that the ones we'll get to and the ones we won't, on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
Do you have an old station wagon full of memories and a busted transmission? Yeah, join the club. Give that car, or any car, a new lease on life by donating it to KUER. We'll have it picked up for you, so really it couldn't be easier. Then we split the proceeds with our car donation partner, and the money goes straight into the programming you love to listen to in the car. It's a regular public radio circle of life. Look under the support tab at KUER.org to learn more about car donation.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, it's our summer book show. We have our local booksellers with us. They have lots of books here, of course, as always, and lists of books for titles for you to be thinking about as you head off wherever you're going this vacation season. We have with us Betsy Burton of King's English, Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books, Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square. So back to Catherine Weller.
Okay, so for nonfiction, I'm going to start with a graphic piece. I haven't done one in a long time, and I think it's really small and unusual, but I think it's really important.
I always like it when you do the graphic pieces. I'm glad you're back to that. Good.
It's called The Quick and Easy Guide to They, Them Pronouns, and it is by a queer gender artist named Archie, and Tristan, a cisgender man who is his friend. And if you don't know what those mean, this little graphic novel is for you.
Great.
It is a conversation between the two of them about how to approach gender in this emerging non-binary world. They are friends, and they are talking to each other. And as Archie, the queer guy, says at the beginning, I'm not talking to myself or my people about this. I want to talk to everybody about this because we all need to know. It is small, it is black and white, and it is inexpensive. It's $8 because it is designed to be
picked up and sold easily and distributed amongst everybody so that we can all, again, get to a greater understanding. So it's called A Quick and Easy Guide to They-Them Pronouns by Archie Bongiovanni and Tristan Jimerson.
Great.
Next is another book about understanding, How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence by Michael Pollan. That is a hell of a subtitle for a hell of a book. Research into psychedelics began way back in the 50s and 60s, and this goes through it with research that was done very early on, great chapters about, say, the therapy that Gregory Peck used in Hollywood, along with many celebrities in the 50s and 60s, before everything was shut down.
Moral panic.
And that always leads to what could possibly go wrong with moral panic, right? There is less moral panic about psychedelics now and a resurgence. We've seen that with Iolette Wildman's book called A Very Good Day, I believe, which is about microdosing acid and how she uses that to treat her own anxiety and depression. Michael Pollan decides to approach this. He missed the 60s in terms of drugs and the drug, sex, and rock and roll equation. So he drops some acid with a guide. He approaches psilocybin with a guide, and each of these is very careful. And then he opens up with each experience, because as we learn, as he learns, these psychedelics open people up in new ways. There's this whole chapter about of an NYU experiment with cancer patients who are dying and how taking psilocybin helps them open up to love and the experience they're going through in the ends of their lives and how they can accept it. Yeah. At the very end, towards the end of this book, somebody says, hey, you want to smoke the toad? Which is just this totally off the wall toad venom psychedelic. And as opposed to his great cautiousness at the beginning, he's like, oh, yeah, smoke the toad. And it was very intense. It's shutting down ego. It's expanding consciousness. It's trying to approach psychedelics not from a place of fear, but a place of exploration. Yeah. So here we are, How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan.
I'll just say he'll be on the show on Thursday.
Yeah.
Talking about this book. And so, yeah, it's really personal.
It's
surprisingly
very personal
for Pollan. Yeah.
It is his steps through psychedelic experience as well as a sociological exploration of it. It's really well done. If you liked his other books, you'll like this. I know the New York Times review was something along like the lines of take psychedelics, but not too much. So there we go. I don't know where I am with time anymore, so
I will quickly say
Energy, A Human History by Richard Rhodes. Richard Rhodes is a prominent historian, award-winning. This book begins with a great letter from a citizen to a politician with the sentence, if there be a resemblance of hell upon earth, it is in this volcano on a foggy day. He's complaining about air quality in his city, and he could be talking about Salt Lake or Peking. But he is, in fact, talking about London in 1659. This human history makes several things clear. I learned so much from this book. One is the law of unintended consequences. Energy never happens without unintended consequences. And advances in energy never happen due to one person or one technology. So it's absolutely terrific. Could have dealt a little more with modern energy, but it is terrific. Richard Rhodes, Energy, A Human History. Quickly, The Order of Time by Carlo Rovelli, one of those little tiny physics books. He wrote, 7 Brief Lessons in Physics. If you liked the brief little book by Neil deGrasse Tyson or that one, you'll like this one as well.
Understandable,
yes. He is very approachable in his physics.
I struggle with physics.
You won't struggle with this.
Good. Okay, good. Catherine, thank you very much. Okay. Betsy, back to you.
Okay. First of all, I'm just going to mention two books and not really talk about them. You asked me in the powers if all this stuff about trees was true. Well, there is a book called The Hidden Life of Trees, What They Feel, How They Communicate, Discoveries from a Secret World by Peter Wulmbin, I guess. I don't speak German.
This is on our list, by the way,
It's on our list, and it is so good, and it will answer all those questions. A new book, Around the World in 80 Trees, beautifully, beautifully illustrated. Trees around the world, but with the difference that they really put them in the context of their environment, which is what we're talking about, the interweaving. Hmm. Which brings me to the book I really want to talk about this round, The Strange Order of Things, Life, Feeling, and the Making of Cultures by Antonio Damasio. Damasio is one of those science writers that you just asked about. Does he say it clearly? He doesn't simplify anything, but he doesn't use that secret science language. And he uses metaphor beautifully. So you really do understand. And his thesis is the same as Richard Powers, that the world is connected in ways that we've never even thought of, and that everything, in fact, is connected. So he breaks apart the duality that started with Plato and probably long before that, and Descartes, I think, therefore I am. The mind and the body aren't separate at all, he says. And a perfect example of that is, you know, why do doctors search for a cure to a disease? Do you really think that it's because they have some idle curiosity? No. It's because their feelings are so engaged because of the horror that the disease causes that they look for a cure. Feelings drive intellect all the time in all kinds of ways. That's in the human body. But in the world at large, he says, everything rests, now don't get scared about this word, but homeostasis, everything rests on that, from the single-cell organism forward. The single-cell organism is propelled forward by a desire to survive and to thrive. That's what homeostasis is. And everything comes off that, and cultures and communities and civilizations are all driven by that same force. Mm. So, you know, bees and all manner of insects do this. Humans certainly do this. He deeply explores the human body and the ways everything connects and everything is part of a whole. So, to me, the reading that I've done, the Richard Powers and the Strange Order of Things, just knocked my socks off because they both gave me a whole new way of looking at the world. On a very
say the title, just
The Strange Order of Things, yeah. Life, Feeling, and the Making of Cultures, Antonio Damasio. He came to Utah and was at the symposium many years ago, and he was brilliant, and I think he's even more brilliant now. So anyway, I'm just jumping on to another topic entirely. I'll tell you what is what Lavelle Edwards always said before he said anything at all. And Ann Edwards Cannon, whom we all know from the Tribune, also works at the store. And this is our publishing venture, our first one, but it is delightful. It is collected essays, but they all revolve around her family and her father. She came to the bookstore. We had over 100 people. They were packed, and they were in stitches the entire night. I mean, she is so funny and so wonderful and so talented. So if you want to just pick up a book that you're going to love and will find totally entertaining, this is it. If you want a book that's entertaining in a very different way, The Tip of the Iceberg, My 3,000-Mile Journey Around Wild Alaska by Mark Adams. He tracks an expedition that took place in 1899 around the perimeter of Alaska, which involved, among other people, a railroad magnate, George Bird Grinnell, who founded the Audubon Society, Edward Curtis, John Muir, and these people took this expedition around Alaska and, needless to say, learned all manner of things. The irony is that there was a railroad magnate and all of these environmentalists together, but it's hugely entertaining and a great summer read.
Say the title again.
Tip of the Iceberg.
Tip of the Iceberg. Great. Ken Sanders, what have you got?
Dead Authors Part 2, Doug.
Okay, good.
The late Charles Bowden has a new book out, though he's been gone 3 years now, and I don't know.
Has it been 3 years?
Yes, wow. It has been. Just come in August, it'll be 3 years. I can't remember how many times you had him on this show.
Yeah.
A lot.
Amazing guy.
With the U of Texas and the Lannan Foundation, they are republishing all of his 25-some books that he wrote during his lifetime, and beginning with The Red Caddy, there are publishing 9 previously unpublished books.
9?
Maybe he and Bukowski are in a race. I'm not sure. We'll see who wins. Put in your bets now. This particular book is a meditation on the late Edward Abbey, who hasn't put out any new books yet. Hmm. It's called Charles Bowden, The Red Caddy, Into the Unknown with Edward Abbey. It's timely because this is the 50th anniversary of Abbey's classic Desert Solitaire. I'm just going to read you the Bowden's opening salvo to his 100-page memoir of his late friend. They used to have a lot of lunches together in Tucson together.
Yeah.
Hold harmless agreement. Warning. Vehicle not equipped with seat belts or airbags. I don't bring a lot to the table. I knew him. We were friends, and we had a lot of good talk. But there were no big moments, dramatic events, or secret missions. There is no cache of letters. I'd pretty much pitch those as they came in. I was trained up as a historian, but apparently the training never took. I am by nature a person who takes things as they come, and that is how I took him. The only thing special about him to me was our friendship, since I don't make friends with everyone I meet. Now I run into people who are struck that I knew him, and I always tell them it was not a very hard thing to do. He was reasonably polite, didn't shit on the floor, and was well-read. This last point mattered to me, since I devour books, and like most such wretches, love to talk about what I have read, and even better, argue about it. He had a similar pathology. I admired what he wrote, and by and large agreed with it. Not just philosophically, but viscerally. I suspect I was born already knowing a lot of what is in his books. Seems to come with a certain ornery cracker territory as part of the blood. So naturally, we never wasted time on such commonplaces, but talked about other things. I have never kept a diary or journal. I really don't keep anything but memories. So I cannot dip into the awesome details of some day or night. This is okay, because nothing was really awesome anyway. That kind of significance seems to be customarily applied like gold gilt by death. At least that is the sense I get from listening to people talk about him and reading what they write about him. I do not share the feeling. I think this translation into desert sage, western god, or whatever is a diminishment of both him and his words. He was a man born to strangle gurus with their own entrails, and everything he ever thought or did is pointless if he is suddenly indispensable and irreplaceable. There's a lot of cheap talk nowadays that uses strange, ugly-sounding words like empowerment. As if power can be given to someone. He didn't think that. He thought we could all take power and be free, and spent a lot of time writing essays and novels explaining just how to do such a thing. In a real sense, if he did his job right, someday we'll stop reading him because we will have taken him at his word and broken out of our industrial cage and moved on to dangerous and liberating ground. I would love to live in a nation where no one read him because everybody already knew what he had to say and had acted upon it. Things are looking up, but I think it'll still be a while before I get my wish.
Charles Bowden. The Red Caddy. That was his first, you say?
His what?
First, it wasn't
his first posthumous book.
Okay. The first one. Yeah, among the 9 that are coming. Okay. Kat.
Okay. Fiction. First off is the latest book by Madeline Miller called Circe. Miller shot onto the scene, I'm going to say about 5 years ago, with Song of Achilles. It took her 10 years to write that one. She is a classic scholar. She wrote that while she was teaching Greek and Latin. And you can really see that background in her writing of Song of Achilles and again in Circe. Mm-hmm. What she seems to do is think of there's a question in something in mythology that comes to her mind. Why is this character like this? And then she explores that in her own work. And what she, that's done a lot, but what she does so brilliantly is she manages to take that telling and make it work as though it is a telling within that period. Mm-hmm. So it is a retelling. It has senses of modernity in it, but it very much feels like a piece of the Odyssey, which is where Circe occurs. Circe is the, she's kind of a demigoddess, a nymph, that lives on the island of Scylla, where Odysseus ends up and lives with her for a while. She turns his sailors into pigs after they kill one of her pigs. And the book starts with her childhood, how she's not valued, how she needs to find her own way, and she becomes an herbalist, a witch who uses herbs and magic to ply her trades and find her ways, and ends up in sort of exile and self-exile on this isle. It is a magnificent retelling. It is beautiful. It's one of those things where I really can't do it justice. Both of her books are so worth reading if you value the Iliad and the Odyssey. These are wonderful takes on them. It's called Circe by Madeline Miller.
And it really is wonderful.
Thank you. I'm struggling for words today. House of Broken Angels by Luis Alberto Urrea is a big, sprawling family epic that is so full of joy and wonder. It begins as Big Angel is getting ready for his mother's funeral, and that sounds sad. And it runs about a week and is obviously running towards his funeral because he's dying, and that sounds sad too. But it is so full of love and the vividness of this American family that lives in California and has lived in California since before it was part of America. And as often happens in that part of the world, people travel back and forth across the border, but they are Americans and part of this society. And it is about the fabric of their family and this society. The characters are so vivid and so warm, and this family is so loving. If you want a lovely, funny read that will make you very happy during the summer, House of Broken Angels by Luis Alberto Urrea is it.
I think a lot of people are going to want something like that.
Very different, and I don't usually read thrillers, is Bearskin. It's a novel by James McLaughlin, and maybe it's because I don't usually read thrillers. I think of thrillers as being pretty urban, or at the very least suburban. This is set in the Appalachians. Oh. And it is about a guy who was down on the border and ran afoul of narco cartels and ends up as the groundskeeper in a nature preserve. And he starts running across bears that are poached for their hands and feet and for their galls. Something's going on. We don't know what. But the story weaves that tale of domestic eco-terrorism with the terrorism that happens with the narco cartels on the border. And it leaves you breathless towards the end. Wow. Very well done. Bearskin by James McLaughlin. Lastly and quickly is The Mars Room by Rachel Kushner. Man, she's dynamite. The Flamethrowers was great. Telex from Cuba was her first novel. The Mars Room, it just blew onto the scene when it came out. And her voice is like no other in fiction right now. This starts with the voice of a character on a prison bus as she's riding to her ultimate place of incarceration. And you get the story of her riding on the bus and the annoyances of the prisoners on the bus and their stories as they're telling them, which she doesn't want to hear, her story of how she ended up there. And then the narrative takes this switch in the middle. The whole structure switches and you think, oh, God, what is happening here? But somehow she makes it work. And ultimately, this book deals with finding freedom and what it and how this prisoner finds freedom, both literally and figuratively. It's a challenging book, but it's a very good book. The Mars Room by Rachel Kushner.
Great. Okay. So I'm going to blow through this last break because we don't have time for it. We're going to go to children's books. Kat, you ready to jump back in?
Sure.
Go.
All right. Hello, Hello by Brendan Wenzel is about language. Simple read aloud book. Great. What are the words? Great illustrations on every page. Just introducing concepts. Someone Farted, one of your producer's favorite books by Bruce Eric Kaplan. He writes books that are offbeat, and this is about owning your actions, really. Yeah. Somebody farted. Do Not Lick This Book is my science book. It's about germs, microbes, if you will. It's a great introduction to microbes. Very simple, very easy to understand, really neat to read. The one that you can spend a lot of time with is Myth Match by Good Wives and Warriors. Yep, that's a group. It's one of those flip books.
Beautiful.
So, yeah, it is beautiful. It's halved. So you have illustrations and then text on the back. And the text that is explanatory is also split. So instead of a dragon, you can have a caprigan. And the illustration is blended, and the explanatory text is blended.
Amazing. Betsy.
Okay, so my favorite picture book is Grumpy Monkey, and you can see the face. I wish everybody listening could see it, of a very grumpy monkey. And the problem is that it's a beautiful day, and everybody keeps saying, "What is the matter with you? Why are you grumpy?" And he tries to be not grumpy. He tries so hard that he practically has a stroke, and he's even more unhappy. So in the end, he bumps into one of his friends who has a fanny full of porcupines, spines, and they sit on a log together and commiserate, and now they begin to feel just a little better.
That's great.
Then We Don't Eat Our Classmates is a book about a young dinosaur who's going off to school and is cautioned by her parents not to eat her classmates. Well, she does. She can't resist. And they really taste good. And the teacher says, "Spit those out at once." And she does. And she just can't get into being friends until she puts her finger in the fishbowl. And this fish hurts her badly. And she says, "Oh, I get it." While the fish says, that tastes pretty good. And then one other kid's story, which is by Avi, that I can't go away without talking about. It's called The Button War. Avi's a wonderful children's author. This takes place in a small village in Poland. And the Russians are there. The Germans are coming. There are six boys who are at war with each other. It is all about war in a profound way. It's just a wonderful chapter book, The Button War, Avi.
Okay, Ken Sanders, less than a minute. Bring us home.
My grandchildren were visiting recently, and I take my children books clues from them. Lyra, who is six, said, "Grandpa, I need Lulu is Getting a Sister," which is the brand new title in the Judith Viorst Lulu series that began with Lulu and the Brontosaurus. So I, of course, got them in for her, and I have to admit I'd been previously unaware of them. They're absolutely beautifully, delightfully books, and they're about a kind of stubborn, misbehaving young girl, which I can't imagine why my granddaughter would like those. And then I've just come to find out, for really young kids, these baby-lit books that you guys know them well. The newest one is All Aboard the National Parks, but Moby Dick, The Odyssey, Don Quixote in Spanish, I might add, and Alice in Wonderland. It doesn't matter. Yeah, is this really Alice? Is this really Moby Dick? Of course not. But they're really, really sturdy. They're colorful. They have beautiful, beautiful illustrations. It doesn't matter about the words because they're for babies. And babies love. They're great for teething on. They got really sturdy, sturdy boards. Excellent for.
And they're good baby words.
And they're good baby words. A great way to get your kids reading.
Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books. Betsy Burton with the King's English Bookshop. Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks. Thank you all very much for being with us. this morning. And for a complete list of all of these recommendations and the ones we didn't get to, go to our website, radiowest.org. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark, directed by Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.